Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
And each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guest is Rocco T. Thompson. You've seen his writing in places like Remorgue, Daily Dead, and Slant, among many others. And he is also one of the co-hosts of the Lady Killers, a Feminine Rage podcast. Welcome to the show, Rocco. I had the pleasure of meeting you this year, and I'm so excited you're on the podcast.
Yes, it was so lovely to meet you, IRL. Terry, I have not had the pleasure yet, but thank you both for having me.
Really excited to have you on. We've been wanting you for a while, and then Mary Beth saw you at Fantastic Fest. I was like, this, we need to get him on. I did notice, as I was doing some Google searching, that you did see Infested?
Oh, yeah. Or Vermines.
Vermines.
I did see Infested.
That's become like a curse among this podcast. It keeps coming up because I don't really want to see it because of spiders.
Terry's mortified of spiders.
Really?
So that's his worst nightmare. Uh-huh. And I was like, if you see this movie, you will die. Like, this is not a movie for Terry.
Yeah, I think it's probably the most traumatizing spider movie ever made. Would you agree, Mary Beth?
I would. I absolutely would. I was fucking freaked out. I'm not scared of spiders at all. And I was like,
it is truly astonishing what they do.
Okay. And then, and Rocco, I think, were you with me? Did we see it together?
You might have been in the theater. I'm not sure if we were together.
Were you with me when I walked outside and immediately a bug flew into my hair and I started screaming? I thought you were with me because we walked outside and a giant bug, like they have these, I think they're roaches. Was it roach in Austin? There's like, you tell me, Rocco, there were big ass bugs around.
I'm from South Carolina. In South Carolina, we would call them palmetto bugs. Yes, but I don't know if that's what they call them in Texas. But yes, it's a roach, essentially.
My goddamn hair. It was right after the bug movie, and it was absolutely terrible. And I almost
would have
pants.
Ceased to be.
I was like, well, that's guerrilla marketing if I've ever seen it. So, and Rocco got to experience that, I believe. So,
that Fantastic Fest planning gets better and better every year and more immersive.
Wow, so immersive.
It's 40x movie theaters when you can have bugs flying at your face.
Exactly.
When they walk outside.
Exactly.
Jesus Christ. Anyway.
All right. Okay, so I want to hear about the Lady Killers podcast. Can you tell listeners a little bit about it if they haven't listened to it yet?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Lady Killers came about because Jen Adams, who is a previous guest on this show, actually, podcasting queen. We sort of struck up a bit of a friendship through Remorgue. I was previously the online managing editor for a couple of years. I still do some, editing for our Halloween issue when I can. And I was, I loved her writing, loved her voice. And she's just so fucking easy to work with. A slut
she's
for a deadline.
She's one of the best writers out there, everybody. I just need everyone to know that Jen
she's
Adams
great.
Is one of the best writers and the most consistent and prolific writers out there. She writes a column for Dirty Central, and I love that woman forever.
Yes, and she needs
she's
to be
very good.
She needs to be told it often, and she deserves to be told it often.
Jen.
So.
We love you.
We love you.
Yeah, so I got her to pitch for the magazine some. I was like, I need you in here. You're amazing and you're so consistent. And grammar's one thing, but being able to have a voice and have a perspective and actually say something is a whole nother bag, and she had that. So we kind of struck up a friendship. Saw a Twitter post one day where she was like, would anyone like to do a podcast with me on female killers? And I slid right into her DMs and I said, totally fine if you only want female identified co-hosts, but throwing my name in there. And she was like, no, I'd absolutely love to have you. So it is me, Jen Adams, Sammy Kuykendall, and Mae Schultz. So Sammy has been on the Losers Club podcast a bit here and there. And she runs the Losers Club Twitter. And then Mae Schultz edits Halloweenies, I believe. Yes. So three ladies and moi. I call myself the token male. And, you know. Yeah. You know, it was a good idea for Jen. We had, you know, we couldn't believe that there was no podcast covering female killers already.
Yeah, that is shocking.
Yeah, seems absurd. And I feel really spoiled and lucky because I've always been interested in podcasting and getting involved in this, but I'm really a virgin to this. And the three of them are old hat at it. You know, Mae is an extraordinary editor, knows all the technical bits and bobs. Sammy is very involved in that world as well. And Jen has started many a podcast. So I'm very grateful to be a part of it. And yeah, we're just getting started. We are already part of the Bloody Disgusting podcast network.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
We got a lot of really positive response from our first couple episodes. I think we're maybe on 6 or 7 now. We went bi-weekly to weekly pretty quick. Yeah, and it's I'm having a blast with it.
What's your favorite episode so far?
Oh,
easy
God.
To choose, because there's not a movie.
Well, our first one on Friday the 13th is really fun, just because obviously Mrs. Voorhees is like the grand dame of lady killers.
Iconic.
Yes, exactly. And it's also really fun just to hear how excited we are and how, you know, we're still sort of getting to know each other. But that initial meeting for that episode was really just really enriching and exciting, and like really gave us like, it was like rocket fuel. We were like, this is great. We have a great rapport, everything. Please be gentle and patient with the sound drops on that episode though, because they were not working. They were not good.
So, you know what? We are very familiar with early editing and recording podcast issues. Uh-huh. Don't you worry, because boy, oh boy, did not know how to record, and my fire alarm goes off a couple times in my old apartment. Yeah, so.
Oh my God.
That's something that happens. When you're podcasting from your house, that it's just going to happen. It's just going to happen.
It's so true. It's so true.
Yes.
But we also just dropped an episode on Revenge today, Coralie Farjat's, I think, 2016
yes!
film.
I need to watch that. I need to listen.
And she retweeted it today, which was really
cool.
Yeah.
That is so cool. Oh
yeah.
My God.
So, yeah, we're really enjoying it. And yeah, it's about female identified killers. My co-hosts are all females. And I'm just grateful to be a part of it and be like sort of the male voice in the room, even though I am a queer man. Female killers are near and dear to my heart. I've previously written a piece for Rue Morgue on female slasher villains of the 1980s. And yeah, I was always more interested in quote unquote girly things. Being a cinephile, I avoided like Westerns and war movies and things like that. I've gotten around to them now, but those were hetero boy stuff. I was much more into, you know, old Hollywood, Screen Sirens, musicals, things like that as a kid. So,
and we just love the girlies, the gays,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. So when I got more into horror, you know, female killers were my jam, and they continue to be. So I'm very lucky to be a part of it.
Wait, so then that kind of leads me to then how did you get into horror? Like you said, you sounded like you were big into movies. You've always been into movies. Like how did this all start for you?
Yeah. So listening back to some of your episodes of this show, I feel like I got into horror kind of late compared to most people.
Okay.
I always kind of liked spooky things as a kid. Like I loved Halloween. That comes from my mom, especially. she always talks about, and we have videos of this. She would dress up as this terrifying witch with a big fake nose and a big chin when she was at her supermarket job, because they were required to dress up in those days, and she would make children cry.
That is amazing. Talk about iconic. That is amazing.
And we have a video of us at home. It was the early 90s, so Smashing Pumpkins is playing in the background. And my sister is like, my little sister is terrified on the ground, and my mom is just running through the house in her witch costume, cackling. It is amazing.
Found footage horror.
It is absolute found footage horror, like the truest version of found footage horror. So yeah, I've always liked spooky things, but I think I was kind of a, you know, going back through my personal evolution for this podcast. You know, I did a lot of thinking, and I think I was kind of a scaredy cat kid. My first movie in theaters, and this is funny because my partner has the worst memory and we always joke about it, but I remember everything. So my first movie was Jurassic Park and I was 3 years old.
Oh.
Yeah. And I saw it twice.
In the movie theater?
Yes, I saw it twice because I remember the second time I went with my dad, we came in, I don't know. So we came in at the end of it. I don't know if in those days things would just play over and over again. That's kind of how I recall. Yeah. But we came in at the end and then waited for it to start again and the film was broken, whatever. But yeah, so my first movie was Jurassic Park. But then by the time we get around to the film we're talking about today and this stuff, I was kind of a spooked kid. So I kind of avoided horror for a long time. My first real horror movie when I got up the guts to watch it was The Ring in 2002. Yeah, so that was a rough one.
How old were you?
I think so. 2002, I would have been 12.
Oh, God. Okay, prime age to watch that, but also like prime movie to really destroy yourself at a formative age.
Yeah, it was rough. It was really scary for me. I think we also, I at a sleepover, we watched the Platinum Dunes remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was rough.
Lovely.
But I don't think, I really don't think that one fucked me up in the same way.
Fair.
But I didn't take horror seriously until I sort of got into adulthood.
Oh.
Yeah, so
okay.
I was always really into movies. Like I said, my parents were, you know, they were also big cinephiles. Like, you know, they had copies of, like, I remember VHS tapes of Naked Lunch and My Own Private Idaho and Fargo in our cabinet and stuff. So, like, my dad's favorite movie is Boogie Nights.
All right, cool.
So we watch it on Christmas sometimes. So
no, nothing says happy holidays like Mark Wahlberg hanging dong.
Okay, yeah. It's so funny that you say that you watched this on Christmas, because here's the thing. I remember when that came out on I think it was probably VHS given the time, and I remember renting it and watching it only because I knew that that there was a giant dick at the very end, right? And so I watched this, and my friends know that we had watched it and we had talked about it. And when one of my friends came over to my house, she asked my parents if they had seen it. And they're like, yeah, we've seen it. And then she starts talking about the dong scene. And
no.
I'm just like,
no,
hiding. Yeah. So I don't have the same relationship to that movie as you do, but that's amazing.
Yeah. My parents were really permissive. And this is really funny because around this same time that Men in Black came out, for example, I remember I was not that way. I'm still, my parents would tell you even today that I was the only adult in my household, even as a child.
That's hilarious.
So I have a vivid memory of my father bringing home a VHS of The Fifth Element. And I was 6 or 7 at this point, okay? And I asked him, is it family friendly? And he said, just to placate me, yes. And I said, did you ask the people at the store, at the Blockbuster, if it was family friendly? Because I knew not to trust him. And he said, yes, I did. Literally just to shut me up. So I was such a little wiener about stuff.
That is amazing.
You were a little wiener.
Yeah.
You were a little weenie. I'm just like, imagine like alfalfa, just like a little, like a cute, like an incredibly well-meaning sweetheart, but also just like a stickler for rules.
Yes.
And
exactly.
Love
that same year, I remember seeing Titanic in the theater with my mom, and you know, the topless nude scene came up, and I covered my eyes, and she said, "It's okay, Rocco, you can watch," but I did not uncover my eyes.
And in that moment, she knew.
Yes, if it was Leo, it would be a different story.
You covered your own eyes.
I mean, this has come up in
That's
the podcast before
so
too, because.
Funny. I love
when
that.
When I was a kid, my parents were fine initially. Like, they got more strict as I got older for some reason. But when I was young, violent movies were okay, but no nudity. And so I had to And so because of covering my eyes for them, anytime I would go see a movie as a kid, like if I was over at someone's house and there was a movie and there had to be nudity, I would cover my eyes because that's what you were supposed
there
to do. So
I had to be nudity.
I can relate.
But yeah, I was that kid forever. Like even I went to Catholic school and in 7th, 8th grade.
Oh, okay. It all, once you said Catholic school, it all clicked. It all made sense after you said that.
Okay, but listen, the kids in Catholic school, they were rough, okay? Like, school. Like,
oh, God, yeah.
But even in, like, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, when kids started, like, fucking swearing, I was like, guys, we shouldn't be talking like this. So it was a little narc.
That's amazing.
Did they bully you?
Surprisingly, I was not bullied that much. I did get bullied by this one guy because I said something mean about his mom, which I honestly deserved. So I didn't get any gay bashing or anything. I just had a mouth on me.
No, it was more just like you being this, like the tattletale and like that guy. I was like, did you get bullied for that? Some kids are, Catholic school kids are brutal, man.
Yeah.
I didn't go to Catholic school, but my parents did. And I know.
Yeah, it was a strange time. But no, I'm very lucky. I didn't get much bullying, so that was good.
Okay, cool. Good.
So since you liked some spooky things, but you hadn't seen horror movies, were you a scaredy cat as a kid?
Yeah, I think so. I really do think I was. And it's funny because I was thinking about, you know, from Jurassic Park, I was just thinking of my own personal timeline, right? Jurassic Park didn't scare me, obviously. I remember having seen Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands and things like that with my parents. And those things didn't really scare me. But then somewhere around 6 or 7, it just started to hit me, like being afraid of everything.
I wonder. That's so interesting. I wonder, it's like when you hit a certain age, like you all of a sudden realize, oh, this is scary.
Yeah.
Like, not that you can't obviously be scared when you're younger, but I wonder if there's like something cognitively, I don't know anything about like child development, but I wonder if it's like a cognitive thing too, as like your brain is growing and like maybe things that you weren't going to be scary before, you better understand the fear factor.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think so. It's also, I think, an awareness of loss and death kind of starts to creep in.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, this is a really dark question.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember when you first kind of became aware of death? That's like a concept.
Yeah, I do.
Terry, you want to take that one first?
Is this too much to talk about?
No, I love this shit. Go for it.
I'm just curious.
The first time I came cognizant of death, and I actually wrote about this. So like in my college years, I took a memoir writing class because I had to take some kind of creative writing thing, and it fit into my schedule. So we read a bunch of memoirs and then we had to write some short pieces. And one of the pieces that I wrote was about the first time when I was a kid and I realized death, and it was like contrasting between being a kid and then losing a friend when I was 16. And like when I was a kid, the first time I remember death and remembering it out of sight of something like that happened in movies was a little bird that I found like flapping on the side of the road. I think I might have talked about this on the podcast.
We have very similar stories. We do have very similar stories.
Yeah. And it died. And I remember digging a hole and burying it. Mm-hmm. And then a few days later, wanting to check in on it. And then undigging it and then seeing maggots crawling through its body and just being like,
oh my God,
this is death, and like freaking out. And yeah,
Terry, that is like something from a movie.
Terry and I had the exact same experience, which is even weirder because I had a same experience of I found a dead baby bird. I buried it. And then I wanted to see if it went to heaven, and I dug it up and it was still there. And I was like, wait, it didn't go to heaven. And then I realized when you die, you don't go, you go under the ground. And I was like 4, and I was like,
when did you reveal this shared experience to each other? Was it before or after the podcast, or were you too faded to be, you know,
we were faded because buddies? It like came up years later. Cause like, wow. that is not a story that you like present to somebody like super
early. Hi, I'm
Terry,
and the first time I experienced death was a bird in Alaska.
Like, but we were talking, I don't even remember, but we brought it up when we were like, wait, did we have the exact same experience as children? And we did. Which is fucked up, so we're soulmates is really what it is at the end of the day.
That is wild.
What about you, Rocco? Did you also bury a baby bird and dig it back up and realize that death is finite or final?
Really, nothing that poetic or dramatic happened to me, I hate to say. But I don't really know when it started. For some reason, this is coming to me, though, because I remember in second grade, we had to write a poem about a color. And I was sort of a serious, morbid kid. Like,
really?
Like, I don't know if morbid's the right word. Maybe I also suffer from depression, and I think I have my whole life. So I was a very serious-minded, a little dark as a kid. Yeah. So I remember I chose black, because of course I did, like a proper little goth child. And I remember the line was, black is death, black is sadness, black is the color of a mad scientist's madness.
Okay, that's amazing, though.
All right. That's incredible.
And my teacher, instead of like getting me counseling or some help, was like, why don't you put some nice things that are black in there? Like cats or, and I remember writing about my dad's sweatshirt or sweater. I don't really remember, but I kind of wanted it to be dark and eerie, and the teacher ruined it for me. But yeah, so I think I've been scared of death for a very long time.
So did you read spooky stuff? Were you a big reader as a kid?
Yes, I was a big reader. I don't think I read spooky stuff very much. I don't have a history with Goosebumps or anything. Cool. I was interested in the covers. I discovered Stephen King sort of in early high school. Love that shit now. But yeah, I was intrigued, but a little too nervous to really dive in.
Oh, okay.
Until cool. I was a little older, I think.
Cool. Well, so did you, now that you love horror and obviously are like a massive fan, do you still find yourself getting scared at all from the horror genre?
I really do not. We talked about on our podcast a lot about this. You know, it's funny. Once you get over that hump of this movie isn't scary, so it's not good, is when you really start to see how great the horror genre is, I think.
Yeah. That's such a good way to distill it. I don't think I've ever actually thought about it like that. Like, what? Huh.
Yeah, because I'll return to things now that I watched when I was in high school that I was like, oh, that wasn't scary, but I missed all the good stuff about it, right? Because I was just looking for that pulse pounding feeling. I was looking to be disturbed. So, you know, all of us are involved with, you know, we all write and things like that. And like least interesting criticism you can make of a horror movie is that it's not scary or that it is scary. Like, duh. So I really don't find things scary now. If there is something that's going to scare me, it's kind of like alien horror. Going back to Men in Black, which we'll talk about.
Okay.
That will really get to me. And that kind of, I think, feeds into my fear of death, existential fears, you know, sense of meaninglessness, being teeny tiny, a teeny tiny speck on a rock hurtling through an empty void.
Damn, so, Rocco's been having existential crises out the womb. Good Lord.
Yep.
Having an existential crisis. I love it.
Exactly. And I think that feeds into the Catholicism also. You know, I'd always thought that was bullshit. I always was not into it, but something about, you know, if Catholicism isn't real, what is real? And is there meaning at all? And alien horror is kind of like, no, there isn't.
Surprise!
Yeah.
Have you seen Fire in the Sky?
Oh, God, Fire in the Sky. Yeah, that is that is the strangest movie in the world because it's boring for 98%. Yes! And then
and then has that bitch scene.
Yeah, bitch slaps you with the scariest alien scene you've ever seen and then kind of just like leaves Fizzles. You. That's it. It's done.
Yeah. But that abduction scene, as someone that's not even afraid of aliens, like, terrifies me. And so every time someone says aliens, I'm always curious if they've seen that one, because it's that moment is great.
It is.
But are there any movies that have scared you recently? Anything that has kind of taken you back to that childhood fear?
Recently, I think Annihilation is one that I really...
Yeah, all right. Except existential horror. That'll do you.
Yeah, that absolutely. One really fucks me up. Event Horizon always, I mean, as cheesy as it is, there's still something really at the heart of that that I find deeply disturbing.
Have you seen No One Will Save You?
Not yet. What are your thoughts? Okay,
I really like it.
And I think it's Alien a blast. Horror,
if Alien Horror gets to you, that's why I'm curious, because it's really good Alien Horror. Like, yeah. I haven't seen good Alien Horror in a bit. I think aliens are hard. I think aliens are really good, but when they're bad, they're fucking bad. So, it does it really well in an actually pretty terrifying way, I think.
Yeah, I will check it's it good. Out. I tried to watch, is it Eduardo Sanchez, the director of the original Blair Witch Project? He made an alien movie in like the 2000s that had a pretty good reputation, and I watched that and I was really disappointed. So, I believe it's called Altered, maybe? Altered might be the title.
Altered.
Because in my brain, I was like, oh, it'll be like Blair Witch, but with aliens. And was not bad.
Now the same group of men will spend a night together in terror. Amazing.
Is it found footage?
It is not. It is the direct opposite of what you would want the movie to be.
The disappointment in that simple O coming out of Mary Beth.
Mary Beth, no time. She has no time for anything that's not found footage. Fuck it.
Fuck it. Okay. Well, now that we're talking about aliens, we gotta get into your Scarred for Life pick. Okay, Rocco, what movie did you bring with you today?
Okay, I brought Barry Sonnenfeld's 1997 masterpiece, Men in Black.
Here come the Men in Black. Galaxy Defenders.
Yes. We are talking about fucking Men in Black, a movie I have not watched in forever, but was one of my favorites as a child. If you are not familiar with Men in Black, please go watch it on Hulu right now. But in the film, Will Smith plays a police officer who joins a secret organization that polices and monitors extraterrestrial interactions on Earth.
All right. So you've sort of teased it a little bit with your fear of aliens. So everything's starting to come together in my mind, at least. But give us your horror story. When did you see this? How did you see it? What about it terrified you? Give us your Scarred for Life reason.
Okay. So my mother would take me on movie dates. I remember this same year we saw The Lost World, Jurassic Park, things like that. So she took me to see Men in Black. And yesterday, watching it back, I had a shock of recognition. Like, I was scared pretty much from the jump. When the jumper's eyes do that thing, like he blinks his inner eyelids or whatever. I hadn't seen this movie in a decade or more. Like, my body remembered. Like, this was when it started.
The body keeps score, as they say. Sorry, guys. It's a terrible joke. It's so funny.
No, okay. My partner's a therapist. He'll love that you said that. So. So I was scared from the fucking jump, okay? Then Vincent D'Onofrio, he was really the problem for me, like, deeply terrifying. I was shocked, like, his entire skin comes off in that first scene. It's like an empty body sack. And I was like, no wonder I was terrified of this.
Splatted on the ground.
And I was thinking, why was this triggering me much more than something like Jurassic Park would have? Of course, I was 3 years older and I was much littler there. But, like, those are monsters I can see. This is the first time I ever saw something that was like, no, monsters live inside people. Monsters can look like people.
Oh, okay.
And what happened as the movie went on is I was getting more and more scared, and my mother was laughing harder and harder at the movie. And in my six-year-old child brain, I remember the exact moment it happened. It's when Will Smith is, shooting the little cricket gun, and he's like smacking into stuff because of the force of the gun. She was laughing so hard, I thought to myself, my mom's a fucking alien. I'm sitting in this theater, 6 years old, fucking scared shitless, and my mom thinks it's hilarious. She has to be an alien. So I sit there and I'm having an internal struggle thinking, do I tell her I'm scared? She's an alien. She's one of the enemy. Like, what am I supposed to do here? So I think I made it till Vincent D'Onofrio pulls the cabbie out of the car and he has the cockroach mouth. He's like, drive me! And his face opens up. And I finally said, Mommy, I'm too scared. We have to go. So that's the only movie I've ever left scared like that. And I don't have a recollection afterwards of, you know, how things, you know, how I felt. But I remember it very deeply in my soul, that thinking that my mother was an alien. Sorry, my dog. Blue, go away. Yeah, but I thought my mother was an alien, and I asked to be taken out.
Wow.
Yep. Mary Beth is speechless.
That's just, it's so funny because, like, this movie is hysterical, but I see why, as a six-year-old, you would think something like that. Like, my brain worked, and I did not have that exact experience, but, like, my brain worked in such a similar way that I was like, I could imagine being like, yep, that's an alien. Like, it's real. And
yeah, this is a documentary. My mother.
Yeah, this is a documentary.
There's a giant roach living inside my mother.
Yep.
Yep.
Did you ever revisit? Like, how long before you watched it in its entirety?
I feel like I eventually saw it when it came to VHS, so not that much later.
Okay.
Yeah, so, but you know, everything leading up to it also, watching it last night, just revisiting it, like, my fear of death also comes in here because I'd seen Beetlejuice, but, you know, that's a sort of a plucky, funny view of death. This is the first time those morgue scenes, I don't think I'd ever seen bodies on tables.
Yeah.
And, you know, reaching inside of bodies, and before the face even opens up and there's a tiny alien inside of there. Like, I think just the sight of dead bodies in that way had me really triggered. So watching it last night also, I'm surprised I lasted so long through it.
Yeah, like, me too.
Yeah, when I asked to be taken out was like 15 minutes from the end, maybe.
Yeah, but I was going to say, it's not that far. I was like, that's pretty close to the end. Like that, because like, you don't really see him as like a cockroach monster until the very end. Like, you see his all fucked up body, but you don't see the full, like really the full form.
Yeah, so I got through a lot of it, but I just remember it just was too intense for me. And I think thinking my mom was an alien kind of made me afraid to ask her to take me out. But what else was I going to do?
So, like, what was the follow-up to that? Like, at what point did you realize she wasn't an alien? Like, I have so many questions. Like, how long were you scared of her? Like, what? Like, did you confront her? Like, how did this go down?
My memory is hazy from there. I really don't know. But the funny thing is, I didn't...
I kneecapped her and ran.
Oh, my God. But I definitely didn't tell her this until my adulthood, I don't think.
Okay.
Which is she did hysterical. Tell her eventually.
Yes, I did tell her. And, you know, she just thought it was hilarious. She wasn't sorry about it at all. So,
well, okay, to be fair, though, like, I can. Yeah, me too. But I can understand sort of because, like, now that I'm thinking back on rewatching this movie and, like, all of the little moments about, like, these humans that are famous, like, you see, I don't know if you were cognizant of, like, Sylvester Stallone or Steven Spielberg, but, like, we see these people that are famous people, and it's like, these are aliens, Dennis Rodman's an alien, of course, you probably didn't get to that scene. But I'm just thinking about, like, how, you know, it's just very matter of fact that there's aliens, and then you see the bodies with the aliens inside, and you're just now thinking, shit, there's something that could be inside a body.
Yeah.
Like, I get that.
Yeah, like, I'm talking about, like, Jurassic Park was monsters I could see in front of my face, but this was something different. Oh, and I forgot the best part of the story. Not the best part, but the adult follow-up, the sequel, the denouement. I worked at an indoor cycling studio in Chicago for a couple years, very 2010s. And who the fuck walks up and signs into a class? I look up and it's Vincent fucking D'Onofrio staring me in the face.
No. Oh my God. But he seems so cool, though. I bet you if you said something to him, he would have loved it.
No, he was amazing. He was really nice. But like, it was like my childhood fear, like a spike of ice down my back.
You're like, I don't know what to do. I know you can't hurt me. Don't worry, son. Vincent D'Onofrio can't hurt you. Are you sure?
OK, Okay, wow. We got to talk about Vincent D'Onofrio, though.
Sure, sure.
Before, like, Mary Beth and I talk about our first time watching this, because yeah. I did not realize until this watch that Vincent D'Onofrio was in this and that he was Edgar. I totally did not put that together. And so I was sitting down last night, and I saw Vincent D'Onofrio was in it, and I was like, who the fuck is he playing? And then I see Edgar come out, and I'm like, oh, he's a baby, was my first reaction. And then I was like, this guy is so good in this movie Edgar? With all the physical acting that he has to do. It is so funny, but also so creepy. And the practical effects that they put on him are just so good. There's a scene early on when he first gets infected, and of course his neck, you know, the first thing you're going to notice is his neck is like just hanging there.
But your skin is hanging off your bones.
I love her, by the way. Beatrice, is that her name?
Edgar?
I can never remember the actress's name. What is it? She's in everything. What's her name?
She's Siobhan. Siobhan Fallon Hogan.
Please. Yes, Siobhan Fallon Hogan, exactly.
She is literally in everything, and she's always incredible.
The house she that really Jack built, Siobhan Fallon Hogan.
Oh my God, yeah. That's right. She was in a movie. Mm-hmm. I forgot about that.
But I love that his eyes are like, they're almost like pulled back. Like it's so uncanny valley and so creepy just immediately before he even starts to become more zombified as
unbelievable.
And I guess decaying as he goes on.
The physicality is incredible, and the way he's able to make his neck, like, I'm assuming there's probably some stuff going on there, like some extra skin, but like just the way he's able to move his body, like, I don't understand how he didn't get more like work doing this kind of stuff, because like for a movie as silly as Men in Black is, like, his physicality is like award-winning, and I know it's like so good to see, and like the way he has to hold his face the whole time cannot be comfortable. Just like that. Like,
I think he's kind of an underrated actor in general.
Yes, I agree 100%.
But I mean, yeah, especially in this, obviously there's some Rick Baker magic going on. You don't really see any of that. And it's really like all down to his performance. But it is strange casting. I mean, an Italian gentleman playing a... a pest control man out in the boonies. Strange.
So I will say, though, the moment where he asks for sugar water and goes, water, more sugar. My husband and I quote that to each other all the time. Like, whenever we have to put sugar in something, we go, more sugar. Like, it is just part of our lexicon now, and this movie is like imprinted on our brains. Like, we only, like, I have not seen this movie in so long, and I have said that ever since I've seen it. I will never stop saying it because it is so iconic to me and so imprinted in my my fucking frontal lobe. Like, good God.
Sugar water, not lemonade or regular water or tap water.
More water. It's just so good. It's so creepy.
He's so good.
It's just so good. And
I mean, another very traumatizing performance. He has two really great ones. The Cell.
I've never seen The Cell.
You guys, what the hell?
I know.
I know.
I know.
You have to see The Cell.
I know. I know. Even I need to.
You know, Tarsem is not my favorite, but go ahead.
I was just talking about The Cell with somebody. Oh, no, we talked about J-Lo the other day.
Yeah.
We talked about Anaconda and J-Lo, and we mentioned The Cell. So maybe this is my sign to finally watch The Cell.
It's a deeply flawed movie, but really kind of spectacular.
That's my favorite kind of movie, so. Yeah.
I think I've seen, of course, the vivisection sequence.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, like, all I know about it.
Yeah, the thing about Tarsem is you're going to get something that looks really amazing, but probably doesn't have a lot going on. Underneath.
That's fine. Honestly, I'm cool with that. So it's very funny, like, your experience with Men in Black, Rocco, because I was taken back watching this and remembering that I loved this movie because I wanted it to be real. I wanted aliens to, like, actually be around because, like, read into whatever childhood sadness you want. But, like, I loved weird shit and I wanted, like, every weird, scary creature to be real. And so this was, like, so exciting to me, the idea that, like, aliens were in existence and you could work, like, not realizing that they're basically, like, alien cops and, like, kind of suck and are, like, constantly surveilling everybody and, like, it's kind of, like, a weird hellscape, but like in my head, getting to work with aliens all the time, like that sounded cool as shit. Like I was so stoked about that. I did forget about the more sugar. I say it all the time, and I know that it's in Men in Black, but then watching it, I, like, forget that it's Vincent D'Onofrio and, like, the absolute, like, madness of this movie being a look at, like, an entire bureaucratic society made up of, of aliens that's paid for by weird patents from aliens that they, like, sold to the government. Like,
microwaves. It's just,
and it's a neutral zone, like Casablanca, sort of weird.
Yes. And like,
what is this?
We're like an intergalactic refugee camp. Yeah. And it's just like so bizarre. And like, I thought in my head, not understanding that like it is an intergalactic refugee camp, like that sounds neat. I was like so into the idea of working with aliens. I watch this movie all the time. Anyway, yes.
Well, I love that idea, though, because, like, anything like this, like, how amazing would it be if there was more than this sad, dying planet that we're living on? You know, there's other stuff out there. That's why this sort of stuff does appeal, you know, appealed to me as a kid, even though this movie scared the shit out of me. I eventually came around to it. But it is that kind of thing, like, oh, I wish this was real. I wish there was something more than, you know, growing up to being an adult and having a boring 9 to 5. Like, I would rather help aliens give birth to squid babies.
Okay, that freeway scene also, like, forgot how much I loved, like, that scene for some reason was to me, like, aliens are real. It was something about, like, a woman giving birth to an alien. I don't know how to fully explain it, but, like, something about that legitimized it to me, and I was like, yep.
This is cool. It.
Absolutely. And look, that's actually kind of a cute alien baby. Hell yeah.
The cutest alien baby. So cute.
I just loved the idea. I loved reading about aliens. I like got books about aliens from the library as a kid. Like, I was so into the idea and terrified of it at the same time, but like always was reading about aliens.
Are you an X-Files girl?
Oh, yes. Very much an X-Files girly. Both of my parents, like my mom and my stepdad and my dad both, like, all watched it. So I grew up on it whether I wanted to or not. And that's kind of what got me into aliens. So I have been an alien girly since I was, like, 4. Yeah.
I've always, like, loved aliens, too. But that's, I think, because, like, a defining moment for my childhood was the movie Alien. Where it, like, recontextualized not just green men coming down in flying saucers, but sort of like this movie, a thing that could be growing inside of you that you can't see. And so, like, after that, I was enamored with monstrous aliens, not necessarily the rumors of, you know, gray men and whatnot, but, like, the idea of aliens being literally alien and something that you can't understand. And I think that's probably why I also gravitated toward this movie, because the aliens in this are not what we typically see in movies.
Well, yeah, and Mary Beth sort of talked about that bureaucratic element, and that's what makes it cool, you know? It's like taking, obviously, an Invasion of the Body Snatchers idea, but giving it a real-world spin, so to speak. And yeah, that's what makes it what it is. They're not just monsters, they're just our intergalactic brethren trying to live their lives.
Trying to make it.
Yeah, trying to find their way home.
It's interesting because I remember seeing this in the movie theater and absolutely being in love with it. I believe I probably watched it a few times on VHS, and then I have not revisited this movie since then. And I think I've seen the second one, but I know I haven't seen the third one because I completely forgot there was a third one.
And a fourth now.
Really?
Men in Black International with Chris Hemsworth. It's not good, supposedly. I haven't seen any of the sequels.
I was not aware of that.
I think a lot of people weren't.
But so when we sat down to watch it last night for prep, and we get to the opening sequence of a man carting immigrants across the border, I was like, ooh, is this movie not going to have aged very well? But I actually really like this opening scene where Kay says, keep on protecting us from the dangerous aliens, in such a deadpan yet like sneering way to these cops that have, you know, stopped and they're going to send the people back. And I was like, ooh, this is actually kind of smart. And mm-hmm. then it takes that as like this idea that all of Earth is a place for people to find refuge. And I thought that's really interesting and very progressive for a movie from the 90s.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Mary Beth.
No, I was just going to say this movie is incredibly progressive for the 90s. It holds up way more than I had expected. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not movies this. Yeah.
I always sort of love that 90s girl power, you know, third wave feminism thing. I love that Linda Florentino is like, or Fiorentino is like, a woman can't be liberated with her sexuality or whatever she's saying when the hand is around her neck. It's just a funny little addition in there.
I will say her wearing the mini dress as working as a morgue tech is fucking hysterical. I'm like, baby girl, sweet baby girl. We know that no one wears this outfit in the lab. Like, that's the 90s is right. That's when the 90s really crept in. And I was like, well, what can you do?
I love a weird lady mortician. That's always great.
And look, Laura Flynn Boyle in the second one has her tits out the whole time. So, you know,
I hear she's mother. Should I be watching that second one?
You should.
Okay.
She's in like black leather with her titties out the whole time and like causing ruckus. And it's incredible. It's
causing ruckus.
Good.
I'm a person who does not miss her in Twin Peaks Firewalk with Me. So, but I will give her a, you know, I'll see if I like her in Men in Black 2. But the politics of this movie, the only thing I have a little bit of an ick with is he introduces Will Smith as Mr. Black and then he introduces him as Mr. White. Yes. And I'm like, what is this joke? What are we doing?
It's a skin color joke. Come on, Rocco. It's so funny. It's funny. It's so funny.
I do like Will Smith saying it's raining black people in New York, though. That's really funny. That's okay.
That was funny.
Yeah.
But the thing that hasn't really aged well for me is him being part of the NYPD. And like, we don't know why he's chasing after this perp. And he just like slams him against the wall and says, NYPD means I'll knock your punk ass down. And I'm like, ACAB?
Hey, he gets out of it. He goes into a shady non-government agency, excuse me.
Hey,
so
look.
We all make mistakes. Even Will Smith. Especially Will Smith.
For the way the bar is on the floor in the 90s for movies like this, those are such like...
Fair.
That is not, and that is not excusing them. It's just so like, it's funny watching this and being like, wow, this could have been so much worse.
Yeah.
But actually, it doesn't like... Again, I feel like this movie could have so easily punched down and made so many terrible jokes that I love how they kind of lean into more of Tommy Lee Jones's like very dry, like reciting of things like policy. And you're like, what the fuck is he talking about with no explanation? Yeah. Like it puts you so squarely in Will Smith's shoes of being like, I have no fucking idea what's going on. And I love how like that is the comedy of it. A lot of the time it's just like how ridiculous the situations are, but how normal Kay seems to be about everything. And it's just like, yeah, it's fine. And you're like, okay. And I love that. And I didn't ever catch that about this movie when I was younger. And so watching it now, I feel like I just appreciate like, obviously the character dynamics, but there's a little bit more going on than the obvious, like, young, cool guy and old weirdo. Like, I like how they play with that dynamic even more.
For me, Tommy Lee Jones, it doesn't matter the age, he is always the cool guy.
And he always looks like that. We were talking about him the other day, me and Terry.
What I love about him is that... I feel like, so, you know, he's a character actor, right? He plays this character and he is hired to play this kind of character. But yet he's a character actor who makes blockbusters and gets paid very well for it. Whereas like typically character actors show up in like a movie and you're like, oh, it's that guy. Whereas this guy, this is his personality that he does, at least in his later part of his career. I'm not 100% sure about his earlier part, but like from like the 90s onward, I mean, you can kind of say he was kind of typecast into this kind of grumpy old man type role, but he does it so well and he was making the big bucks and I love that he was a blockbuster character actor.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting because like he is the grumpy old man role, like the rules guy, but he also is a bit of a loose cannon.
Yeah.
So, and I think that is such an interesting dynamic that he's playing, walking the line between those two things all the time. I actually just watched The Eyes of Laura Mars, and that's the earliest I've seen him in anything. totally this disturbing to see him as a young man. It doesn't make any sense. I can only
imagine. I've actually never seen that movie and I want to.
It's good.
He's looked the same his whole life, it feels like. Like in every movie, I feel like he just kind of looks like an old, like, craggy man who's like been through a lot of shit.
Oh, and the funny thing is, he's retiring at the end of this movie. He had to be 49. He was 50 when this movie came out, 49, 50. I'm like, could you imagine a world where we get to retire at 50 or retire at all? Like, wow.
Please. Capitalism.
Exactly.
But you did kind of bring up something that I was thinking about as I was watching this and taking notes last night, is that what I think this movie does incredibly well is that it allows both characters to sort of play the straight man as well as the, like, funny man, because like there's a lot of times where Will Smith is our entry point into this world, and so he is reacting like, I don't understand what's happening, and we're acting like that because Tommy Lee Jones he's very deadpan, but he's very funny and he's allowed to do these very silly things. And so we kind of follow Will Smith, but then of course, because Tommy Lee Jones is so stone-faced in a lot of times, he is also like the straight man. So like, it's not just like an odd couple where it's like one is one and one is the other. They kind of interchange it. And I think it's so fascinating. It creates a fun kind of different dynamic than I'm used to in these type of buddy comedy movies.
Yeah, I would say you really, I mean, I sound like a old boomer now, but I'm like, I feel like you really don't find chemistry like this anymore. You don't have movie stars like this anymore. Will Smith, like, he got this role, I think, because Steven Spielberg, I'm saying something wrong. Somebody very involved liked him on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Like, this is like the real start for me of Will Smith's box office, you know, stardom. He's at the height of his charisma here. Yeah, I just think this is a movie where you can see two stars firing on all cylinders, and it's all about their chemistry, and you really don't get that in other places. And you really don't get that anymore, in my opinion.
I agree.
Yeah. And I wanted to say also, this is by Barry Sonnenfeld, who I just revisited both Adam's Family movies.
So
the
good.
Dude, he's kind of like the poor man's Tim Burton, but like in the early 90s, he could not fail. Like, he knew exactly what to do with this material. His filmography is kind of cursed now, but, you know, up till this point, just amazing stuff, and just the perfect tone, and very smart, but also
he's
cartoonish.
In Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
Who?
Yeah, he did Wild Wild West.
Barry Sonnenfeld. Oh yeah, that was the beginning of the end, I think.
I love that movie. I know it's not good, but I just really enjoy it. That's good. He is cartoonish. He hits a very interesting cartoonish vibe, and he hits that like adult cartoon vibe very well, and I love that for him. I feel like that's really hard. Now that I think about it, it is kind of a hard tone to strike.
Absolutely. And the way also that he sort of, we talked about things being slightly dated. I think there's like a Michael Jackson joke in the Addams Family Values. There's the CD joke in here. Like, oh, this little disc is going to replace CDs soon. Barry Sonnenfeld stuff, there are those little jokes in there that kind of, I feel like, do date it in a way that Tim Burton doesn't have those, you know? But they're very similar, obviously, especially because of their Danny Elfman connection.
Yes. The opening of this is pure Tim Burton with so following good. The insect. I loved it watching this as an adult, though, because you see the stars and you know it's an alien movie. Mm-hmm. And so you're watching this and you're just like, okay, where's the UFO? And it's just this insect. And it's smart because it reverses expectations of seeing some kind of like UFO crashing. But then also the movie is about bugs. And so I love that it's sort of like, it's sort of like a, you know, a subverting your expectations about what the movie is going to start with, but then also being like foreshadowing that, no, we're going to be about bugs. And I love that we follow
lots
this insect
of
with
bugs.
Lots of bugs. We follow this insect with Danny Elfman's majestic score. I have not seen this movie in forever, but the moment that score came out, I was like, yes, I remember this so much.
Absolutely. Nothing brings me back to childhood like a Danny Elfman score. You know,
seriously.
I love Batman and Robin. Same year as this, actually. 1997 was a banner year for me. for little Rocco. Which one is it? Batman Returns, especially. That was a big film for my childhood. And yeah, Danny Elfman, I miss his work. I know he does stuff still, but in this early 90s period, just the dark whimsy that he created and the tone that he gave to every single one of his movies, like it brings me right back to being a kid, and I love that.
Same. Score of my life, like as a kid, for sure.
Oh my god, yeah. I played some of his music at my wedding because I was like, everyone. So yeah, during like the dinner service, I had like horror soundtracks playing. So there were some of his iconic songs playing whilst we ate.
That is so great. I also kind of wanted to say like how big this movie was. It was everywhere. It was the third highest grossing film of 1997 and the ninth highest grossing film of the decade. Won Best Makeup and was nominated for Best Art Direction and Best Original Score at the Academy Awards. And going back to my Catholic school, so I don't think I had seen the film yet, but we always had an eighth grade versus faculty basketball game, which I think was, you know, a fundraiser thing. And the eighth graders that year were called the Kids in Black. And I remember them singing the song and everything in suits before I'd even seen the movie. So it was inescapable.
Again, it's that era of having the catchy ass song that plays everywhere that is like directly written for the movie and is like about the movie. Like it's Ghostbusters. I mean, Men in Black. And it's so catchy. And it's Will Smith and he was like hot with his music career too. It was just like, it is such a 1997 movie if you really think. Like everything about it like is so 1997 and I kind of love that. It's like... Wow, look at the world before like the 2000s hit and everything kind of started like fully, like really, I mean, not that things were great, but you know, I don't know. It feels very like of that era.
Yeah.
And it's so cool in a weird way.
And interestingly transitional though, especially with the effects because, you know, the effects were, well, Rick Baker's there obviously to do the practical effects, but you also have Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas's effects studio there. I think I actually read that the bug at the end was they actually had a fully animatronic version.
Yeah.
But they swapped it out for the CGI version. And like looking back on it, the CGI is pretty rough. I think especially that screensaver it ends on with the earth inside the marble.
It's so bad, but I love it. I love it's saying, but it is watching it now, it really I was like, ooh, yeah, the CG, so I think the effects look really good throughout most of the movie to the point where there were times where it was like, I can't tell if this is a practical effect or if this is CG. And it inserted them, except for a couple times with the coffee aliens when they're walking through, I don't know what they're called, but the little sluggy like coffee aliens that were my favorite as a kid when they're walking through the facility towards the end of the film. I was like, ooh, that's a little iffy. But other than that, like the way that they inject the CG with the practical effects in here looks better than a lot of movies today for me.
It does.
And that's what surprises me.
Yeah, and it still has that handmade thing. Like, even the CGI, you can tell it was made by human hands. Also, a big part of it is all of this was filmed on location in New York. It was not in a garage in Atlanta someplace.
Yep.
So, I mean, even that bug scene at the end, you have this giant CGI bug, of course, who's the villain. But I was just shocked, like, oh, wait, an actual background does so much. Like,
it does.
It's incredible.
The sense of scale, I think, is something that even though we have big blockbusters now, I feel it has been lost because it is just people standing in a sound screen and there is no connection to the outside world. And every single time I see stuff, I can always feel like they're standing in front of a green screen or a blue screen or an LCD screen or whatever they're using to, you know, project images. But in this particularly, there's the scene that you can obviously tell that it is green screen when they shoot at the UFO and it's like coming down and it crashes through the thing and crashes in the ground in front of them. And they're obviously standing in front of a screen. And yet it feels more realistic than a lot of the same kind of things they do today. And it just made me appreciate the scale of movies. And you mentioned, Rocco, the handmade feel of movies that I honestly do feel is missing in blockbusters today, for the most part.
And that's the thing. CGI is supposed to be a tool. It's not supposed to be the whole thing. Like, here you do have CGI aliens, but you have some practical aliens, and you have all of those handmade, like, weapons and doodads that are all over the place. Like, there's just so much texture and so much character from the New York setting. You know, it wasn't even supposed to be set in New York. Barry Sonnenfeld wanted it set in New York because it's kind of a funny joke, and it's a lot of the jokes in this movie. It's like, oh, New York's so weird. New Yorkers wouldn't notice aliens.
They wouldn't
New York
notice.
Is so crazy. But But I mean, all that texture goes a long way. And then like you can appreciate the CGI even when it's a little wonky, because you still have the sense that it's, I don't know, something is there. Light is hitting objects around it. Someone has labored over this thing. It's just not computer generated glop and, you know, somebody on wires. So,
yeah.
Or a tennis ball and a stick.
Yeah. And then also, I love that we're covering people in slime. Like, I love that when that first alien dies and it's like silly, like blue silly string all over everything.
Favorite. And it's just hanging from his hat. My favorite moment.
I love good slime.
That was one of the moments that was like seared in my head as a kid for some bizarre reason. And so when I was watching it, I was like, I totally remember the blue silly string hanging from his hat. It's so real in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I miss that. And I love any time that they wipe people's memories when he's doing it to Linda Fiorentino and he's like, you're going to give her brain cancer. It's the funniest thing to me.
Did any of you ever go to Universal Studios and do the ride, the Men in Black ride?
No.
Yes.
Oh, my God. So I've only gone to Universal Studios once, but I did. The Men in Black ride was one of my favorite rides.
It was great.
From what I remember, it was a really good ride. And I was so stoked to do it because I love Men in Black. I loved the second Men in Black. I loved the TV show. So I was like so excited to do it. It was like an interactive roller coaster type thing, I think. I remember it being. And it was neat.
See, going back to like the coffee worms or whatever they are, the TV show ruined those for me because those little fuckers were all over that cartoon. You could not get enough of them and they annoyed the piss out of me.
See, that's, even as a kid. Honestly, that's the problem with commercialization because like it's a moment that is so small and like it's funny. I love them in this movie. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, people like that. We should just up them and make them, you know, everywhere. And that's what it ruins the charm that they have, in my opinion. And you see that happen in a lot of movies, particularly when like kids are like, ooh, I like that. It's like, well, that's what's going to get the kids in the seat. So we're going to like amp it up.
Well, that was Frank the Pug too, didn't it?
I was about to say.
Yeah, because they did that. Because I kept getting the first and second one mixed up watching this because I was like, why isn't Frank in this more? But I was like, oh, and the second one is when they bring him in. Because that's also, I saw this around the time I also saw Little Nicky, which also had a talking, like, demon bulldog.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I got all of my weird, fucked up, wrinkly dogs in New York City mixed up with each other. But Frank, like, all of a sudden became, like, a big character because it was a talking dog. Like, hee hee hoo hoo ha.
Cultural icon, Frank the Pug.
But he's only in this movie for 2 seconds and they shake him around a bunch and it goes little hoodie.
He is actually shaking that poor dog. Like, I'm watching it last night. You can tell it's a real dog the whole time. It doesn't cut away or anything.
That terrible CGI mouse.
Okay, but honestly, kind of like, I was about to ask that talking about the effects. That flappy mouth is almost better than like the Disney Lady and the Tramp remake they did with fully CGI dogs.
Whoa. Honestly, whoa. Fair enough. Yeah. It was just so funny just to be like, it's just so funny. But yeah, fuck. I love the second one too. I haven't seen it in a long time, so I can't remember it, but I just remember dying at a joke because one of the aliens is called a Balchinian and it's an alien with testicles for a chin. And my stepdad always used to, my stepdad, because, you know, grown men, would pause it and we'd all giggle. And he's like, look, there's a hair on it, and would like make jokes about there being pubic hair on this alien's chin. Yeah.
What are y'all's favorite aliens in the movie? Or Mary Beth, you did answer the Balchinian, but is there anything that you're particularly drawn to? Any background characters?
I really love the tiny little alien. And like, because it's, I love the tiny little alien because I loved that, but I also love that
the prince,
but then the really tall guy was in Twin Peaks and he plays a character in Twin Peaks.
Oh yeah.
Carol Struckin.
He's one of those guys I feel bad for because I feel like they cast him because he has a very distinctive look and I think he literally has giantism, so he has like a very distinct look.
He's
and
7 foot.
I feel bad that he's always cast as like the weird
Lurch
character.
I think they say in this there's quite a bone structure going on here.
Yes, oh yes, they do. And I'm just like, this poor dude. I just like, there's a part of me that's just like, I mean, good for you, but also like, you're so always
he works
cast.
All the time. He works all the time.
He's also in Gerald's Game.
Yeah.
He was the Moonlight Man.
I love Gerald's Game. I love that film. I love that.
He's always like the weird harbinger of doom or like of some weird message in the moonlight. And it's like, well, I mean, I guess it works. I also love the cat.
Great.
Orion.
The cat. Oh, yeah. It's really cool. It's a good cat. What's the name of the blue alien at the beginning who is one of the immigrants? I can't remember.
Oh, yeah.
I really like him, though.
His name's Mikey.
Yes, Mikey.
Oh, love and my other favorite is in the second one when it's like Kay has gone and is working at a post office now. There's an alien that has a bunch of arms and sorts all the mail, and you just see him like throwing all the mail. And like as a kid, I just thought that was like so neat. He had a lot of arms.
Terry, what do you like?
Specific job.
There's one shot when Jay and Kay are walking through the headquarters, and I think it's the first time that we're seeing like all the aliens just sort of milling about. And there's one that looks almost like a caterpillar or something.
Yeah.
It's like kind of whitish.
Don't talk and it to looks, him. He's grouchy.
Yes. Yeah. Good boy. Yeah. The big caterpillar.
I loved him. I was like, yes. That is a really cool design, and that is what I liked as an adult. As a kid, I probably liked those little alien things and the bug at the end, which has not aged 100% well, but
I don't know. I think his expressions are really good.
They
I don't
are.
Know. Like he looks a little wonky, but they really, I mean, they put so much effort into making it work. And I think it ultimately does work.
Like, I think it ultimately does work. Cause like, I can tell, again, they tried really hard to design it. I just, I don't think it fit the world very well. I think maybe it was like.
Well, I know what you're saying, because everything is so imaginative and weird that like a giant cockroach is not that interesting.
Yeah, it's like everything else is like so visually interesting and like kind of different and whimsical. And this one feels very like sci-fi. And like this is, I know this is a sci-fi movie, but it's like whimsical sci-fi. And that felt more like... This is a very weird way to describe it, but like this movie feels a little bit softer, and like the cockroach feels very pointy and sharp, so it doesn't feel like it fits in the world as well to me. That's a very weird way to describe it.
No, I think that's completely fair.
Makes sense. I think what for me also, just because there's a lot of buildup to what is inside Edgar, because we only see like that arm come up and grab him, and we see like him inside, and we see Edgar's body literally like rotting. Like I was watching this as an adult thinking, man, they are really pushing the zombie aspect of it, because his eyes get kind of cloudy and you see them get progressively more cloudy as the movie goes on, and his skin is just looks more rotted, like it's decaying. And so like you see this and you see that moment that you mentioned, Rocco, where like the thing comes out as he's attacking the tow truck guy.
So
and
scary.
I'm like, what is happening here? And so you see all these like little hints of it. And then at the end, it's like this giant cockroach. And I don't know, it kind of loses it for me as an adult. I don't think I really cared about it as a kid. Like I was like, ooh, this is exciting. But as an adult, I'm like, it feels kind of a letdown after this sort of buildup of what is inside this man that is causing his body to do this for me.
Yeah, definitely as a reveal, it's not amazing. but also, this is funny. So I definitely got some toys of this before I'd even seen the end of the film. and I remember having Vincent D'Onofrio's bug truck. Extermination truck, and inside of it was the flying saucer, and it opened up and the cockroach was in there. I did not know what he was. I had no fucking clue until I actually sat down and watched the movie again. So, because you know, I missed the last 15 minutes because I was too scared.
That's incredible.
Some of the little asides in this movie kill me. I love when the the Archilians are threatening to destroy the Earth, and they get this one message that says, "Deliver the galaxy or Earth will be destroyed. Sorry." It's just that little sorry at the end that I'm like, oh,
it
that
is
little
so
detail.
Funny.
And like that's what makes it feel so lived in to me. It's like not these like typical like scary. It's like they feel more human, which sounds funny, but like they don't feel like these big scary monsters, but more like they're just creatures trying to live their lives and like get shit done. You know what I mean? They're just like, look, we don't have an agenda other than like, please don't let this bug like kill everybody. Like, I'm sorry. And I like that, having aliens feel again more normal and not alien.
And also just, you know, smart writing. We're so, you know, cinema is so marvelized now, and it's all, well, that happened sort of comedy. But this is a really clever, really funny script. You just have really good actors in these roles. Like I laughed out loud at Rip Torn saying, "May I ask why you felt little Tiffany deserved to die?"
May I ask why little Tiffany deserved to die?
We're not hosting an intergalactic kegger here.
We're not hosting an intergalactic. Oh my god, his voice is so iconic. I love it so iconic. Much. God damn. R.I.P. Rip Torn.
Yes. I love Jay's response to that, though, because it made sense. It's like, yes. That guy has a tissue. The other one's just doing pull-ups. And then this little girl is reading quantum physics. That's wrong.
Never trust a little white girl. Don't do it.
No.
Trouble will follow.
As someone who was a little white girl.
And I love, oh my god, the scene where they're taking the test and they're all in the egg chairs is just such brilliant physical comedy from all these no-name actors. They're all just...
Yes.
It's incredible. It's incredible.
It's such a good critique of, like, government bureaucracy and, like, such a wild way. Like, oh no, we're not government funded. They ask too many questions. Like, I just... It's a really smart critique on, like, government bureaucracy, I think, and I vibe with it.
It's the little visual things, too. When Will Smith's character walks into the place the first time, and it's just this man sitting in a chair, and there's these two giant fans just blowing. I'm like, what is going on here? But I love it. It's never explained. It doesn't tie into the story whatsoever. It's just the security guard sitting there in between two giant fans. Great.
Everyone needs to watch this movie and then play Control.
Yes. Oh my god, yes.
I've been meaning to play it for years.
It's so good. It's so good.
Is it? Okay. But then
with the egg chairs, I love the image of Will Smith just getting up, grabbing that table and dragging it. And it's so loud. Yeah. It's such a good comedic moment that doesn't require jokes. It's just so funny. The visual storytelling is great.
Want to get in on this? And they're just like...
It's so funny. Yeah, and like, the thing is, it's a lean hour and 38 minutes, and I feel like it covers a lot of ground. Like, we've lost... I will talk about this till the cows come home, just about how movies just used to be better. You know, like... Mm-hmm. The script is full of jokes, but they're all pretty smart jokes. There's a lot of visual jokes going on. And like Mary Beth said, it's a critique of bureaucracy. You get a lot of character work, especially with Kay about his wife that he misses and stuff, all visually. And it's just enough, you know. It's just a really, for all that's going on in front of the screen and all the effects that are happening, there's like beautiful simplicity about it as well. Like, it's just a sleek, smartly written script, and a well-told story. And I think I really miss that. Blockbuster filmmaking in the 90s was unmatched. So
unmatched.
Yeah.
I love the tabloids. Again, visual joke.
Yeah.
It explains the world. It's funny. It's something that we're familiar with because we see those all over the shopping malls and all that kind of stuff. But I love that in this world, when you think about it, Batboy is real. Because in this world, he would be real.
Yeah.
And I just love that.
And Elvis is still alive.
Yeah, love that. Love that. A line that really stood out to me, though, and a person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals. It hit me like a ton of bricks.
Now that I'm thinking about it, because one of the things that I used to say in my teen years and into my early 20s was, I hate people, but I love persons. And I honestly think that that's probably from this.
No, they stole it from you, Terry.
They did. Purely my own thought.
It's your intellectual property. Sue.
Yes, I'm going to sue them.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
One final thing. Linda Fiorentino, I feel like her career was sidelined by men because apparently, because like I was like, was she in the sequel? She wasn't in the sequel. Apparently,
that's Rosario Dawson. And
Tommy Lee Jones did not get along. And so the rumor has it that Tommy Lee Jones would only come back to do the sequel if she wasn't there. And then in 1999, she did Dogma with Kevin Smith. And he went on like a podcast or something and said, like, he's talked about how difficult she was to work with.
Shit.
And then she hasn't made any movies since 2009.
I hate that. I hate that bullshit. It's the Megan Fox effect, you know? a woman stands up for herself or doesn't agree with a director and she's blacklisted.
Yeah, because like she literally 1999 and then she had a couple movies in 2000 and one in 2002 and then she did one movie in 2009 and then that was it. That's it.
So, but there is a female agent in the second one, Mary Beth, right? But it's Rosario Dawson, you said?
Well, Rosario Dawson's the love interest. She's not another agent because I believe, I think Patrick Warburton is his, like it's two, Jay has a male partner and then Rosario Dawson is the love interest. She's not an agent, but she comes in earlier and she is... Yeah.
That really sucks. And see, that's such a 90s thing, too, at the end of the movie. It's like, ladies can be agents, too, you know? Like,
just kidding. She's written off the show. Oh, she left. She left the agency to go back to join the morgue, is, I think, how she was written off.
And, like, also, I honestly and truly feel like the Men in Black 2, as much as I loved it when I was younger, like... I clicked on it on Hulu just to start watching the beginning to be sure. And, like, literally, Lara Flynn Boyle starts out in, like, lingerie and, like, is naked and immediately gets attacked by a man. Like, it's so 2002. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they, like, regressed in the politics of it.
They definitely did.
You went from, like, having some funny critiques to, like, really weird, annoying sex jokes. And it's just like...
Well, yeah, it's almost like, oh, you women want to be sexually liberated? Well, here comes American Pie to make you look like fools for being sexually liberated.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to take advantage of you. It's really fucked up. Yeah, the 2000s were really rough. So,
yes.
The girl power 90s were preferable to me, but...
But see, I also really
liked
Linda.
Thanks, 9/11. Sorry.
Yeah, right? Seriously.
It's true. I could talk about that for years.
Oh yeah, me too.
But I think she's really funny. I think she's really funny in Men in Black. Fiorentino. I think she has she matches Tommy Lee Jones's deadpan delivery so well. I loved her. I was really impressed with her. And that's like, what else has she been in? And then that's when I realized, oh
yeah,
yep.
Yeah, she's fabulous in this, but it's a shame. It's a shame.
I think she's incredibly underutilized in the movie, too, but...
She is.
It's a guy story, I know. Can't be perfect. Can't be perfect.
It's a movie for the boys.
Yeah. It makes me want to go watch Jade, though, because I think she was the star in that, and I think that's an erotic thriller from 1995 by William Friedkin.
Oh, yeah. I think that's... I've heard really bad things, but I've always meant to see it as well.
I've heard terrible things about that.
I love a bad movie, though. Bad reviews are not going to keep me away from a movie, so.
On that note, do we want to wrap up and give this our rating out of 5?
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
All right, Terry, you're up first. How many ill-fitting skin suits out of 5 do you give Men in Black?
I think this movie is a blast. It has aged incredibly well. I think it's funny. I think the action is great. I think the scale of it is fantastic. I'll tell you, I could watch Vincent D'Onofrio do physical humor all day long after seeing this. I was just so surprised and delighted that he was Edgar, because I didn't realize that as a kid. I think this movie is fantastic. I wish more movies that were blockbusters were doing the same kind of mix of being satirical, being funny, being filmed in the real world. Mm-hmm. So I have to give this 4. I'm going to give it 4 ill-fitting skin suits out of 5. What about you, Mary Beth?
I'm also going to give it 4 ill-fitting skin suits. I was not sure how it was going to hold up, and it held up super well. I was pretty impressed for a 1997, like, I don't mid-budget? Like, I don't know, huge budget, but, like, mid-ish budget buddy alien movie, and... I love that it's still as good as I remember being from when I was a kid. I love when movies can do that, and I love when movies have that kind of power, because a lot of movies don't have that kind of staying power. And, yeah. But Rocco, you have the final word. How many ill-fitting skin suits do you give Men in Black?
So, coming into this, I probably would have given it 4, but, you know, talking it over with you fine folk, I do think it sort of, you know, stands as a monument to a type of blockbuster filmmaking that is dead. I mean, the Twin Towers are in this film, you know?
Yeah, they sure are.
9/11 was not the cause, obviously, of the Marvel emergence.
But, which, by the way, this is a Marvel movie.
Yeah. And what do you mean? Because it's based on a comic book. Shit.
That's owned by Marvel. And Marvel is literally in the beginning based on the Marvel comic.
No, Terry.
It's a Marvel movie.
Terry, no, don't. I don't want to know that. I wanted to forget. I mean, maybe the 9/11 is responsible for the MCU, but that's a paper by somebody else, not by me. But I do think, you know that the last vestige of this kind of big budget filmmaking with interesting ideas, a mix of CGI and practical effects, like the perfect sweet spot between the two, with actual stars at the height of their star wattage, giving their all to it. Steven Spielberg's Amblin Entertainment, like the height of his producing ability. I think I have to give it 5 skin suits out of 5 because there's nothing else like it anymore.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, it brought me back to being a kid watching it, I have
Did
to
it?
Say. Well, a teen. But yeah, it brought me back that feeling, like it just unlocked that memory. So fantastic. But thank you so much, Rocco, for joining us to talk about Men in Black. Where can our listeners find you? And the floor is yours. What do you want to plug and talk about?
Yeah, well, first of all, please follow The Lady Killers, a Feminine Rage podcast. We are at The Lady K Pod on Instagram, Twitter. I believe maybe Blue Sky, if anyone's on there. give us a rating. I love a rating. We need more ratings and reviews. You can also follow me at Rocco T. Thompson on Twitter, especially if you are interested in celebrity thirst. You know, men are meant to be objectified. Ask ladies before you objectify them. But men, it's, you know, free for all.
Free for all.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I am at Rosemary's Gaby on Instagram and Letterboxd.
I love that.
Very good.
That
very, very good.
It's a great handle.
Thank you.
Well, listeners, you have heard from us, but we want to hear from you. What was your experience with Men in Black? You can send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com. Or can let us know on social media. I am at MB McAndrews on Twitter, and I am at MB.McAndrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gilly Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, follow the podcast on socials. We are at Scarred Podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky, and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there, but most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.